Good morning. We'll get started in just a moment. Rob Sandlin, can I ask you to, in just a moment, to lead us in a word of prayer? We'll get started, but folks are still getting settled and all that. If you will, turn to, well, I've moved my page on myself. What page have I got in front of us here? March, it's the beginning of March 1st.
267.
Okay, yeah, 267. Wants to look and consider here this admonition, this instruction regarding movement of boundaries, and maybe expand on that just a moment. We'll start there this morning. Anyway, Wednesday night we kind of did at best an overview, certainly just treetop, and looked at a few things that people had on their minds. And so we're going to try to start on March the 1st today and see if we can't get ourselves a little closer to the actual time that we're reading. Rob?
Liz? Our all-wise and merciful Heavenly Father, we thank you for this opportunity that we have this morning to come and worship you. In particular, with that, we're thankful for our classes, that we're able to dig into your word and look into the intimate parts of it and be able to apply those things to our lives. And help us to become better children of thine and be shining lights as we go out into a dark world. We thank you for our teachers this morning. We pray that you will bless them and their efforts. Please watch over us and pray our worship to you today will be acceptable. In Christ's name we pray.
Yeah. Okay, I wanted to start here with talking about boundaries, because kind of interesting. They're being told about boundaries. They're not even in the land yet. There are no such markers set up for them. So this is in advance of reality that they would deal with. But look at, do not remove, come on now. It's not over there. Do not remove your neighbor's boundary stone set up by your predecessors in the inheritance you receive in the land the Lord your God is giving you to possess. So here, before they even enter the land, there's more than an admonition, an instruction, a command, that when these boundaries get set up, don't you go sneaking out there and moving them around. What if everybody, I think, in our culture is rather has some familiarity with property lines and how your property maybe sits next to a neighbor's property. And you know, if you build something or start going across that property line and doing something over there on your neighbor's property, you're going to be accused of. You're going to be said to have what?
Trespassing.
Encroached.
Trespass. Encroachment. Think of the word trespass. But I suggest to you that maybe there's sort of a biblical, a principle of God up underneath this. Certainly, there is the part about being truthful and honorable and not being deceitful and deceptive and, those things. But let me just suggest this too. Can I suggest to you that part of what God's doing with all these laws is that He's teaching His people that they're going to have to live within certain boundaries, within certain bounds, that they're not free to go anywhere, go do anything they want. They don't get to decide what the boundaries are. That belongs to God, a holy God, all-knowing, a God incapable of making a mistake. And He's going to put boundaries around them. When they go outside the boundaries that God has described in their morality, that is a trespass. A
against God. It's sin. We don't get to decide what the moral boundaries are for our lives. The Creator, the Holy, the Just, all-knowing God does that. And so this system that He's setting up for them in multitudes of ways are just all consistent with the kind of people they're to become. They're to become people, and Brad may have some comments on this because he and I had a private conversation one day last week. But he's teaching them to be people of self-discipline. And that self-discipline has to be in alignment with His will. When we get to the New Testament, you start looking at those lists of the kind of, that describe the kind of people. Almost inevitably, on at least a couple of those lists will be self-control. And that control is that we learn to live within boundaries, because when we go out of those side of those boundaries, that's when we get ourselves in trouble. That's when we get ourselves out of fellowship with God. That's when sin gets into our lives. So this notion of they're going to be boundary set and those things are not to be moved willy-nilly from somebody. I assume that if they bought a piece of property adjoining them, the boundary stayed the same. It just was now who owned that next parcel or the next portion of a parcel, something like that. When those boundaries once set were set. So I think there's something, underlying this. And I'm going to go a step further. Time and again we've talked about covenants. You see how important and solemn these covenants are with God and what His expectations are on the performance of the people within these covenants. And all those are premised on promise or promises. What gives a promise any value? Think about it just for a second.
Credibility of those who got it, the person who offers it.
What was the first word you used?
Credibility of the person who offers it.
Okay. A promise is only as good as the, Gary says, credibility. And I think might add a word, fidelity, to that. See where we're headed with that? We've got nothing, but we don't have anything but an empty promise. If the promise comes from an entity or to someone who either has no intent to carry it out or is willing to rethink it at some time and change, or is incapable of carrying it out. But when the Holy God, all-knowing, all-powerful, makes a promise, unlike the promises that I make, I'm sure if Casey thought for a few minutes, she can think of a number of promises I probably have broken to her over her lifetime. And your children would too. So you can have intentions to do right. But the truth of it is that these covenants and these promises of God are premised on bedrock that, quite frankly, as humans, we don't possess that ability, that certainty, that sureness. And Hebrews adds this additional element where the writer said that, when God makes a promise, God who cannot lie, when He makes a promise. And so that's what is underneath a covenant. And He is setting up all these rules for these people and how they're to conduct themselves. And you know, without sanctity and fidelity of promises, you can't have contracts. People don't know what to expect. It is very, very difficult to construct a society. It's very, very difficult to construct an economy. You know, if the game gets changed, that's why it's so important in this country. Do judges get to reinterpret law and decide that, hey, now in this age, actually, you know, written words mean something different from when did? Because once you do that, then no contract, every contract is subject to reinterpretation, and so the bargain, say, that people made really is not the bargain they made, it's the bargain somebody else, some later point says. So it's very profound here what God is doing to these people. They're going to be able to count on those boundary lines. They're going to be able to count on all these promises that he gave them. He's giving them rules that are consistent with this in all these aspects of their living. And it adds a certainty to it, but it does impose upon his people certain boundaries and a discipline that is going to make them starkly different from all these nations around them. The nations that he is using them to displace have sinned against him. If we get as far as the sexual sins a little bit later, we will see that in fact, God is using them for a purpose, because these other people have gone off in idolatry. They've, performed all these terrible, licentious acts. When men get to decide what that they will live beyond boundaries, inevitably, when men get to decide what I call sort of religions or religious orders, far more often than not, it will ultimately involve sexual acts. It's an excuse for men to come up with a way to just give themselves over to sexual appetites, be outside of God's boundaries. And we see that in the world we live in. We see that, I'm not saying every religious body, but so frequently it is tied to that. And that's the world in which the Israelites live. We're going to possess this land. So anyway, removing boundaries. I just want to make those points, and about the trespass is really tied to trespasses against God. And when we trespass against each other, it's outside of our boundaries. It's a trespass against God situation. Anybody got any thoughts or comments? Brady, you want to make that comment? If you recall it.
conversation. That's a little bit different than what we talked about. But what impresses me here is the balance that is achieved. That you've got these very rigid commands about not moving your neighbor's boundary stone. And so what that does is set up family property. And so if all the family lives within this property, then you get family clans, you get a provincial sort of a community. And then at the same time, we'll read later in the reading today about how they are expected to take in the alien and make them part of the community. Well, which is it? Are you supposed to be exclusive, or are you supposed to be, broaden the community? And if you dissect this out, it all has to do with the way the law is set up. It's allowing people to be free moral agents. And yet there are rules, there are inhibitions. And so what this law is teaching them is this enormous spectrum of inhibitions against the backdrop of freedom and liberty. So in our society, what you see is all these people want their freedoms. They want the liberty to do what they think is right. And they want to ignore everybody else's liberty and freedom, and particularly ignore the instructions of God. And so what this law does is, as odd as it sometimes seems to us, it's teaching these inhibitions. And so the way that our brain works then is that our brain has this enormous capacity to weigh options and to base those options upon learning and experience and environment. And so you see certain pathological conditions where people don't have inhibitions, where they don't have inhibitory neurons in the brain. And it's just a life gone amok when that happens. And so, unfortunately, what you see in society now is an attitude of there should be the only inhibitions or the inhibitions that I think you ought to have. They aren't the inhibitions that I need to have. And so anyway, I'm impressed on this reading this year. I'm seeing that more than I've ever seen it before, about how this instills in a nation of people godly inhibitions that then carry over into every relationship.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, and so the all-knowing God who created us knows what's best for us. He puts these rules in for no telling how many different reasons, and kind of gets to that New Testament question in 2 Peter chapter 3, what manner of people ought you to be? Well, I'll tell you what kind of people you ought to be. The kind of people that God has described here that live within these holy boundaries. Something, a point I meant to make, and I didn't do it. We were talking about all those different kind of sacrifices and offerings. How many of those offerings were made because of the sin of Adam that was passed down and everybody inherited? Not one. It all had to do, you know, there certainly as a nation collectively, it all had to do with what did the individual Israelite do. Nowhere in all that vast system was there ever a mention or hint that there was some kind of an inherited rolling sin that had come to them by virtue of Adam. They sinned in the same way that Adam and Eve sinned, a personal decision to do the wrong thing, to step outside of the boundaries, to trespass against God, to miss the mark and things. But just a point on that. Look, if you will, I've already kind of touched on it, but the how important the sanctity of contracts and agreements, that oaths on page 271 at the bottom, that there's a collection of things here that when don't fair swear falsely. That's false swearing when we make a promise, an oath, that we're going to do something and that we don't do it. That is important. We need to, God's people have to be the people that belong to God. And when we do, we profane the name of God, particularly if it's in some way an oath premised upon its being before God or things of that nature. But New Testament principle, you know, really carries it farther. Let your yea be yea, your nay be nay. Your word is good. Your word is bond. People can count on it. They can act on it because it's going to be carried out. The next section here that agreements are to be honored right in here. When a man takes a vow to the Lord or takes an oath to obligate himself by pledge, he must not break his word but must do everything he said. Talk about vows of young daughters. So there was a series here of items in this particular section about vows that are given between people, particularly these between wives, a vow of a widow, a divorcee. A question I guess would arise, well, what about a widow? And is she bound by her any vows or obligations she makes? She no longer has a mate. And the answer was, yes, sure does. And talked about the husband's liability for vows made by his wife. So You know, underneath this, if you made a promise, just like God, when he makes a promise, is going to carry out, his people need to be that kind of people. And in the next section that that our editor has given us, he's put weights and measures, that those things that oftentimes in some way are what effectuate some agreement by somebody. You know, I'll give you this much money for this weight of something or this volume of a grain. Those need to be honestly measured. Brad and I grew up in a hometown on the coast of Texas where the big oil tankers would come up and sit just outside the coast before it could come up to the big oil refineries. And they would have to take on a pilot that was trained and knew the ship channel that leads up to Port Arthur, Texas, and on up to Beaumont and a place or two in between, where at one time many of the world's largest refineries sat. And these ship captains, these men, there was a limited number of them, and they were highly trained and highly compensated. So one of the most well-to-do people in our hometown was Captain Fredeman. And his wife, Citalise, was the toast of society for decades. She hosted everything, and they had this huge house and all this. In the 1980s, it came out that a side business that Captain Fredeman had, and he realized that, hey, he knew all about the oil industry. He knew about the Intercoastal Canal and these boats that go up and down the Intercoastal Canal that runs along the southern part of the country from really the bottom of Texas all the way to Florida. You can take barge traffic and a lot of stuff, particularly oil, moves that way. Captain Fredeman had seen the opportunity early on and realized, well, tugboats, while they're in the middle of the Intercoastal Canal, need refueling. And so he set up a barge company called Intercoastal Towing and something or other. And these his big barges carrying fuel would go up and down the Intercoastal Canal and in midstream could refuel tugboats. And it, you know, it's not like they have a meter on them like you do when we get our gas at the service station. Here, they would take a big old stick and drop it into the barge, and it would tell them, they'd measure the level of fuel that was there when they began, and they'd crank up these huge pumps, and they'd begin to, you know, pump the fuel and, I don't know, big old lines over into the tug, and they'd have these huge capacities. And then they would drop the stick, measure again at the end when that had been topped off. And that difference was how much they had to pay for and all that. Came out in the late 80s that the Captain Fredeman's businesses, tankers, had all been constructed to have false bottoms. So that the people measuring knew to drop the stick one place at the beginning to get a big count. And then when the tug was full, you drop the stick in, but you do it a little further over and it would hit a spot and would show a much bigger difference than it actually been trying. And they had been doing it for years and years and years. Huge, you know, scandal, and, you know, lost everything. Captain Fredeman suddenly became mentally incompetent to stand trial, all this sort of stuff. But the notion of using false weights and false volumes has been something that's been a problem forever. And of course, it's a form of stealing, it's a form of deception and all that. So here from the very beginning, God lays into this and tells these people, because they've not really been merchants, but they've been slaves, and then they've got 40, this generation, older generations coming in, have been nothing but wandering around out in this wilderness for their lifetime. So he puts in the requirement for the importance of weights and measures that are accurate. There's several things in here about all of them that are that are interesting. But if I could drop over and just for a moment, let's see what page, 276. Quite a bit of what God spoke to them about. Had to do with sexual purity. And the way our material has been organized by the editor, he begins it with God's intention that his people are going to live in a way that is in stark contrast to the pagans. He said, "Speak to the Israelites and say to them, I am the Lord your God. You must not do as they do in Egypt, where you used to live. And you must not do as they do in the land of Canaan." So both Egypt and Canaan are offensive to God in the way that they live. "Where I'm bringing you, do not follow their practices. You must obey my laws and be careful to follow my decrees. I am the Lord your God. Keep my decrees and laws, for the man who obeys them will live by them. I am the Lord." So he tells them, you're going to be different from Egypt where you came from. You're going to be different from these people that you're going to be dispossessing and replacing in Canaan. And so as he gives these rules that they're to live by, you know, starting with adultery, you know, it appears to, you know, I think probably undergirding most societies pre this time, even there was an understanding that it was a violation for somebody, not so much for the man, but for the woman to be unfaithful in some way for a husband. It would seem, for example, just the story of Joseph and Potiphar. I mean, it would have been no, and Potiphar's wife, I guess, there would have been no defense to Joseph to say, yeah, but she wanted me to lie with her. He knew that. He said, this is a sin against God for me to do it. He also pointed out it would be wrong with regards to the husband who's entrusted Joseph with everything. He's not withheld not a single thing except his wife from him. But here, it's very explicit that there's not to be adultery, and there's descriptions of these various kinds of situations. You know, on this page we're looking at, oh, and the penalty is severe. They must die. You must purge the evil from Israel. I mean, it was serious. This wasn't just a misdemeanor kind of, you know, that you're being naughty, don't do that. This was a death, a capital offense to do this. And so, you know, he goes through, we've got such things as adultery with one that's betrothed, the situation about slaves that are betrothed. There's a test for adultery. What do you do when a man suspects it but can't really prove it? There's a whole procedure for that, or maybe even another way to look at it, a procedure by which a woman perhaps falsely accused of adultery, the procedure by which would go through to take care of, address that situation. Fornication, which would, you know, involve unmarried, is certainly included in this. Talks about prostitution. He warns them against prostitution. Let's see, I think, didn't it say, do not degrade your daughter by making her a prostitute, or the land will turn to prostitution, be filled with wickedness. No Israelite man or woman is to become a shrine prostitute. You must not bring the earnings of a female prostitute or a male prostitute into the house of the Lord your God to pay any vow, because the Lord your God detests them both. Clearly, there's a practice of having religious shrine prostitutes in this land that they're going, that has idolaters in it, and even It's not limited to female prostitutes, but there are also male prostitutes involved in this land where they are going. So he warns them and says, you're not to be those kind of people. You're not to do that. He has rules against incest. And, of course, these are redrawing some boundaries because we've read time and again leading up to this during the time of the patriarchs where people would... Abraham would marry a half-sister, Sarah, and we've seen countless or many of those kind of situations. With no explanation, God puts a stop to that. It's maybe inferred that, it served his purposes, it's propagated the world. There are a lot of new rules here that he's never communicated to people. This is not a law that somehow was inferred or had been whispered in Noah's ears on a lot of this stuff early on. Clearly, the sons of Noah. How do you propagate the world after repopulate the world after the flood? So he goes through all these different things to teach them about sexual purity, because God has made mankind very clearly, he has hardwired us to have sex, and virtually every the normal condition would be to have desires between the sexes, and that's given to us from God. But he's put boundaries around it. It's not left to individuals to just decide that they can satisfy themselves anyway. And so we particularly begin to see it as we go forward, but I think in the New Testament too, much more so, the clarity which the importance of sexual purity, and that really God has some big purposes for this. And it actually even becomes a type, that has to do with the relationship between Christ and the church. And so this tawdry, kind of illicit, just no self-control kind of thing, it just stands in such stark contrast. But the fidelity with which the underlying covenants and promises, the vows between a husband and wife, define their relationship, and between those two people just becomes unbreakable. They will not violate that. And then it's got this, benefit, because God knows what's best for us, that therein is how mankind can have their highest and best satisfaction. And I'm not just talking about physical satisfaction, I'm talking about the intellectual, the emotional, that's there to carry people for a lifetime and to go through hardships and go through disappointments and all that. And so God is giving them laws that sometimes seem like they're restrictive, but in fact, they're what's good for us. And in fact, allow mankind to operate at the very highest level of functioning. And it prepares them. This temporary abode that we're in and during this period of time and on earth is really preparing God's people for an eternity, in heaven. And it's teaching us these lessons that we need to learn. And you can't learn it by being a philanderer or someone who's unfaithful. You will not learn those lessons. We will not prepare ourselves to be the kind of people that are going to be in heaven. So he's teaching them this, and none of these other countries, they sure don't have, more often than not, pursuit of virtually unlimited satisfaction of sexual desires is tied to being to their religion. And having a way to pay money to keep up these shrines by engaging in relationships with either the female or the male prostitutes.
So there's just this stark contrast, and these people are going to be somewhat naively, I think, going into this land and going to be confronted with that, because these are the people that were children in Egypt. They might have been aware of some of that, but they weren't surrounded by it. And you know, I think there would have been a certain naivety to that. They certainly got themselves in trouble with the, who was it, the Edomites? Who were the ones that the priest had to come and, you know, put the spear between the man and the woman as they were engaged or about to engage in, you know, illicit sexual, and I forget. Which people were those? The Moabites, down the southern, I think it's Moabites. So, you know, they're one kind of getting close. You know, what was it, a couple of thousand people lost their lives? I mean, God told the priest, you just go through there. And just all these people that have participated in this, you just clean house with them, kill them. And so they've had one taste of it and did not do well in withstanding the temptation. So God is giving them this, and no other people had been given such such strict instruction. Let's see them. I want to go to page 280. I really think this is the thing. Where does this come from? Leviticus 18, starting verse 24. Do not defile yourselves in any of these ways, because this is how the nations that I'm going to drive out before you became defiled. These nations had descended into this. Because again, our point, Satan does not care. There's nothing you can do to desecrate yourself that Satan says is off limits. You can just get as filthy as you want. People can live at the lowest forms of humanity, and Satan's okay with it. And so, in fact, the nations that they were going to replace had been going down that path. So, let me try this one more time. No, I'm not. Let me see if there's a pointer on here. One moment. No. He said, but those nations became defiled. Then he says, even the land was defiled. So I punished it for its sin, and the land vomited out its inhabitants. When you read, this is in Romans 1, but it might be in chapter 2. I mean, even Paul says that even the creation groans. It reacts to this. I don't understand that. I think it's a fascinating concept. But I think this is something in sort of the same line that even the land was defiled, and the land vomited out its inhabitants. But you must keep my decrees and my laws. The native born, the aliens living among you must not do any of these detestable things. For all these things were done by the people who lived in the land before you, and the land became defiled. And if you defile the land, it will vomit you out, as it vomited out the nations that were before you. Everyone who does any of these detestable things, such persons must be cut off from their people. Keep my requirements, and do not follow any of the detestable customs which were practiced before you came, and do not defile yourselves with them. I am the Lord your God. And he says this bottom line here, I am the Lord your God who has set you apart from the nations. So God is actually, you know, we kind of lose sight of this, but I think we've mentioned it before. Part of what's going on here, God is using Israel as an instrument to bring about judgment upon a people that he's been very long-suffering with. He would have given them mercy. We do not know what kind of prophets God may have raised up among them. We don't know what kind of Jonahs may have been sent to those people from somewhere. We don't know what kind of Melchizedek type of people, not as priests, but types of folks that God may have tried to use as instruments and fell on deaf ears. unlike Nineveh later. But God's headed. And the time has come, and the Israelites are coming in, and they're going to displace all these people, and those nations are going to go into end. Anybody got any comments or thought about that?
You know, next, and it started at the bottom of the page we were just looking at, but all this about leprosy, about the skin diseases, all these things that required the people when they, when something was going on their skin, that, that they were supposed to go to the priest and show it, and he was supposed to inspect it, and then there'd be some period of time where they'd have to come back, but in the interim they would be quarantined, they'd be isolated, and there would be a series of things, and the priests were given these instructions about what they were to look for, and all that. Turns out there's a non-contagious kind of skin condition that can be maybe confused with leprosy, but it's not leprosy. Boils are a problem. They even give instructions about burns. It goes further about things that cause itching, spots, baldness that is brought on by some kind of skin condition and disease. There are rules for the sick. There's rules about if you find mold in your garments, mold and mildew has to do with that. Mold that gets in their house, where you could just replace the stones where mold was, but if after looking at things, there were conditions upon which you would just totally destroy the house to get rid of the mold. Very explicit. When you're living under those kind of instructions, my question is, do you think that it trains people to start making personal inspections? To look at themselves and not just, you know, turn a blind eye to their home, a blind eye to the condition of themselves? And I think the answer is no. I mean, it would, if you let this go too far, you really were in a mess. And so it would begin to teach this principle about purification, that God's people have to be people of self-inspection. Look at God's rules for us, His laws and His commands to us, but we're to be, you know, measuring ourselves against it. How are we doing? Are we seeing anything amiss in our life? Are we seeing, you know, instead of disease, sin in our lives? And so that's really the undergirding of this. All of this for purity of His people, for healthiness of it, also has a spiritual side to teach us to be people that do self-inspection and do it sooner rather than later. Finally, let's go to page 287. I want us to end here with these. There's all these things about cleanliness and what they can eat and all this, but look up here at the top. Didn't do this very well, but he says, "Be holy because I am holy." And on this one page right here, he keeps coming back to that. Let's see, I think I got it right here. "You must therefore make a distinction between clean and unclean animals, between the unclean and clean birds. Do not defile yourselves by any animal or bird or anything that moves along the ground. These which I have set apart is unclean for you. You are to be holy to me because I, the Lord, am holy. I have set you apart from the nations to be our own." God's intentions is for mankind to be holy like He is. But we've got a problem with sin that separates and breaks our fellowship. And so that's the big dilemma. And how can this be bridged? And they've told us about different kinds of sacrifices that we can have that are temporary, that help remove sin, but only to the point that the people were attentive to do that. But God is saying, I've set you apart. He does it at the bottom of that, the same page, the same opening. This page ends on the same notion. You are to be a people holy to your God. And then finally, the last item I wanted to try to cover today was that right here, let me call it to your attention, having to do with blood. They were to not eat blood. He makes this principle. You must not eat the blood of any creature, because the life of every creature is its blood. Anyone who eats it must be cast off. So that was the significance all along of these sacrifices and all these precise things were to be done with the blood. And we know that that's what's really going to come to fruition in the New Testament, Jesus Christ being drained of His blood. It's His blood that's going to cover our sins. It's the payment, because you know, by His blood being poured out, His life was poured out. And then, of course, every Sunday morning, and here in about 20 minutes or 30 or 40 minutes, we're going to be partaking and drinking the fruit of the vine, which represents what? Blood of Christ. So He was given these principles. Blood equals life. And that undergirding principle, you know, is really going to come to great significance in the New Testament. Thanks for your attention.